Bredocast. Wir erforschen was mit Medien.
Welcome to the Bredocast. This is a podcast of the Leibniz Institute for Media Research in Hamburg, Germany. My name is Johanna Seebauer, and in this podcast, I am talking to media researchers about their work. Today, in this episode, we are discussing something rather groundbreaking, I would say. The social media platform Facebook, we all know it, has for the first time in its history allowed researchers access to their headquarters to investigate in an embedded fashion the platform from within. And two researchers of our institute were the first to study how Facebook develops rules that shape how 2.7 billion people communicate. These two researchers are here today, Wolfgang Schulz and Matthias Kettemann. Thanks for coming.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I'm very quickly introducing you, and then we jump right into the topic. Wolfgang Schulz is one of the two directors of the Leibniz Institute for Media Research. He also teaches media law at the University of Hamburg and is, besides that, also a director at the Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society in Berlin. Matthias Kettemann is a senior researcher here at the Leibniz Institute for Media Research. He is a speaker of a research program that focuses on how rules and new practices of communication develop in digital spheres. And he is currently also a guest professor at the University of Heidelberg teaching international law.
That is correct.
That is correct. Wonderful. Just some meta information. We are all German speakers, but we decided, since this topic is quite international, to speak English to also make this podcast more accessible for people that don't speak German that well. Okay, so let's jump right into the topic. The two of you were able to investigate, to research Facebook from within. For researchers, Facebook has been sort of a black box, I would say, for quite a while. You could do research about how Facebook influences how people communicate, how Facebook influences the news consumption of its users, et cetera, et cetera. But it was very hard to look inside and see how this company works from within. How, and I will ask you, Wolfgang, now, how did this whole project come about? How did you gain access to the company?
So the starting point is that I think for a couple of years we are studying the structures, normative structures of public communication. And what we saw is that private ordering, what companies like Facebook and others do with their codes of conduct or their standards, has become more and more important how to influence public communication. Secondly, we heard very often in conferences, we need more information about how these rules come about, how they are constructed, what are the procedures in which they are construed, and so on. And people always said, it's impossible, you cannot look into it, you needn't ask, because it's for sure that you wouldn't get access. And we said, challenge accepted, we will try. And so we started a conversation with people from Facebook, and I think we were lucky because after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, there was a debate within Facebook. What does that mean for us? Should we now be completely closed for academic research, or should we even be more open and have a more structured access to our internal information? I think building on that, we were able to convince them to give us access at a level that has not been granted before.
And who did you talk to at Facebook? Was it Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, or was it who was it?
So I did talk with Mark Zuckerberg this year, but it was not about this project. So our main point of entry is expert at Facebook who's coordinating the stakeholder groups, and academia is one of those important stakeholder groups. And so he is the first point of contact and was extremely helpful in organizing how to get access to the working groups we wanted to study.
And was it hard to convince them?
It took a while, maybe six months or even eight, to be frank. And I understand that because if it's the first time, you have to develop the rules. You have to convince a lot of people internally, and the lawyers always are an obstacle. I know that because I am a lawyer by education, and so that took a while.
So you were sort of negotiating for 6 months, and what did you agree upon in the end?
So our agreement is that we can have, could have access to all the relevant working group meetings that take place in the process from the first signals that the community standards of Facebook might be changed until the final decision about these changes. So we could have access to all the steps from this first initial thought about changing the rules to actually changing them or deciding that they should not be changed. And that is, you will see that in our paper, that is a very complex process within the company, where a lot of people outside the company play a key role. And to have access to all these different settings was key for our research. And we negotiated that we can have this access.
Mm-hmm. The paper that you just mentioned is now published as a preprint and will be published later in 2020 in a peer-reviewed journal. We will, of course, link to this in the show notes. So the goal of your project was to find out how Facebook develops rules for communication on its platform. Matthias, then you went over there. You went to California to spend some time at the Facebook headquarters. What was your impression? What did you do there? What was your daily life?
Mm-hmm. Sure. But first, just to add perhaps that we were only able to do this project because of the level of trust we have been building and the research that Wolfgang and his team has been conducting over the last years on how communication changes and how the roles of private actors influence the way we communicate also in public settings. I was very happy after long discussions with colleagues from other disciplines to be able to conduct first-hand research there, to talk to participants of various working groups, because you have to imagine how complex normative change happens. The product policies, the rules of communication within Facebook are by now an intricate order that is constantly evolving and changing. When they receive so-called signals, so for instance, problems in application of certain rules or reversals of moderator decisions, when they see that there are certain issues which need to be dealt with, they start a working group process where they first talk about the different possible changes that policies can undergo. And they will then start consulting with stakeholders. And those stakeholder processes are among the most interesting parts of this whole policy change, because they identify who they want to talk to, which opinions they believe can impact the product policy change process. And I was able to attend these meetings and listen in to the calls. and found it incredibly interesting how much effort is being put into proceduralizing this, you know, into trying to get more legitimate outcome. Because of course, you know, Facebook is no traditional legislator. They don't have the advantage of the state, that they have a certain intrinsic legitimacy in setting rules governing how we communicate. So they need to find a way to increase that legitimacy, and they're doing that by this ever more intensive attempt to integrate the opinions of different stakeholders. I found my time there very interesting. I kept extensive notes, and based on these notes, we then developed a couple of theories on how Facebook structures the normative change.
Could you give us an example of a concrete rule that of what one of these rules could look like?
Absolutely. So one of the new product policy guidelines I was involved in related to the question how people that change their gender identity are treated. So though this might seem like a niche problem, it very much touches upon the human dignity of people who are either gender fluid or who have changed their gender identity. What Facebook saw, what their moderators saw, was that in certain circles, these people who had changed their gender identity were attacked by, for instance, being called a gender pronoun they no longer identified with. So, for instance, a woman who had changed his gender identity into a man would be referred to by the old gender pronoun. And Facebook, through a number of meetings with experts, tried to find out how exactly this harms people who change their gender identity, and how they can develop a new rule under which circumstances using the wrong gender pronoun would be a violation of their guidelines. Obviously, this is an issue where you have no global norms yet. There are no human rights standards clearly telling a company or a state how to act in this particular example. This would be one of those cases where a court would have to consider carefully how to weigh freedom of expression and human dignity, perhaps also the protection of privacy. And Facebook is anticipating how courts would do that in their process of setting norms. So they're privatizing in a certain way, not only the legislative function, but in a way also the judicial function, because they're setting the norms and their moderators are then enforcing the norms, which makes them both the norm maker and the norm and the judicial sort of the quasi judicial actor, and also the norm enforcer, because it is still very much within their competence to then enforce the decision by, for example, suspending somebody. So they are really monopolizing a lot of power, a lot of normative power, and this is why it's so important to enter into this discussion and to open up the process of how those norms get developed. And we're happy that we were able to contribute a bit here.
That must be very interesting as a legal researcher to look at companies like Facebook.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I would even say that it's extremely interesting to look at these companies more generally. We are focusing on Facebook because we were able to gain access there, but Facebook is by no means the only company setting private rules, and it is arguably even if you can criticize the slow speed of of opening up its internal decision making process, it is much much farther evolved in terms of accountability than other companies that where we as researchers have to rely on leaks to find out a bit about their moderation practices. So it's always easy to criticize, but we should also say when we that it's important that the company took this step to engage with us.
Mm-hmm. And you just said that Facebook is not the only company that sets private rules. Why is it so important that we look at Facebook? Are we giving it too much importance, maybe, as a research institute?
So I would say, in general, our institute's perspective is not to look at one type of medium and within specific types of media, not just one company or one specific service. And I think that is a good approach. And in public debate, sometimes the role of social media platforms, and especially Facebook, it's a little bit overstated. We just look at the new phenomenon and neglect that there are still other things around, and traditional media plays a role. But Facebook is an extremely important player in this respect. And we might learn something which is interesting to study with other companies as well, and to compare it, see whether there are different styles, see whether good practices emerge, link that to our thinking about what should be the normative order of public communication. How can we ensure that the fundamental freedoms are guaranteed in a system where we have a very complex interplay between state set rules and rules set by companies? So that's one of our main research interests for the next years, and this is a very important cornerstone to build this research.
Mm. Yeah, it's a bit like Jane Goodall and her research on big apes. You know? Of course, what she found out about the normative order of apes, you know, cannot be transferred to all kinds of monkeys, but still, you know, it's an important example of how of these kinds of animals interact. Here also, without, you know, comparing any company to any animal, Facebook has a very powerful position because it is also treated by political actors, including the EU and including governments, as an exemplary object of regulation. You know, it's very much seen as the, you know, as the epitome of a social media company.
Mm-hmm. Now, Facebook has made quite a few negative headlines recently. If we think of Cambridge Analytica, for instance, it's not so far-fetched to think, okay, Facebook might be doing this, opening up to researchers to also appear as more transparent and to maybe also whitewash a little bit. What do you think of this?
So I think it's definitely true that they want to show that they are transparent, but I think that's not a problem if they are in fact transparent and open up like that. I think that is a motive. I think another motive why they granted us access is that it is interesting for them to learn about their own procedures from an outsider's perspective. So they have their own interests, and everybody has that. We have our research interests, they have their interests. We don't think that we engage in any whitewashing here, because we just depict what we have observed and what was important to us for this research. Two things. One is that it is embedded in a theoretical framework with a developed methodology, and it's not just opportunistically seeing, oh, that's something happening here and jumping on that. That is, I think, extremely important when you do this kind of research, to make sure that it is actually academic research that serves the academic community. That is important. And the second thing was that we wanted to make sure that apart from access, we don't get anything from Facebook. There was no funding of anything. We paid for our flights, for our accommodation and things like that to make sure. We just want them to open up, and everything else is our business.
And could Facebook, in the end, influence the findings that you got?
No.
Or the content of the paper that will be published?
No. What we agreed to, and we talked about that a lot, because that is something that they are allowed to review the paper, but just for two things. One is privacy issues, and the other thing is trade secrets. They did not request anything on this basis. So the paper that we will publish is not influenced by anything that Facebook says. But I think we have to make transparent that there have been this process. If it had been just interviews, we wouldn't have agreed to this kind of procedure, because when you say that, and then we have to do that. But when you are embedded there, you see everything, and you can look at things that have to do with personal data of users or personnel of Facebook, or you could accidentally look at something which is something that is in development and has not been announced so far. And so at the end, we agreed on this procedure. We know that it's kind of pioneering work, and we welcome a discussion about what is the proper method when you do this kind of embedded research. Other sectors of academia have more experience with that. For us, it's relatively new to do that. So it was not only pioneering in terms of research questions, but also in terms of how to engage with this kind of mega big company that is in the public debate every day.
And adding on to that, here at the Leibniz Institute for Media Research, we truly find that you get to the best results scientifically if you combine the disciplines. You know, we have a strong focus on regulation, on researching regulatory issues, but also on doing that based on empirical evidence. So we combine media studies and regulatory studies, and we did that in this project as well. We have, I would say, a third of the paper at least is dedicated exclusively to our methodological approach, where we clearly lay out how we come to the conclusions. You know, we don't have mice where you can replicate your study on. What we have is honesty about our methods and clarity about our results. And we're very happy to engage with the global scientific audience. We feel very confident in our insights. But of course, we are aware that since this is a first of all a pioneering study, and secondly, it's a case study of one company, an influential company, no doubt. But still, it's based on one company, that not all results will be generalizable. But in the run-up to the project, in the run-up to the embedded phase, we held extensive consultations with colleagues from ethnology, from sociology of media, from media studies more generally, to ensure that our approach is firmly anchored in current scientific methodological discourse.
Matthias, you were basically doing classic field studies at Facebook by assisting or observing meetings of the team that creates the roles. So it's sort of an ethnographic research, we could say.
Well, we did talk to people with ethnographic and ethnological background. We wouldn't call it an internet ethnography, because they counseled us that usually these kinds of embedded phases would have to take longer to be a real embedded time. You know, they were talking about periods of 3 to 6 months at least.
How long were you there?
For 1 week, but we only saw this period as one, you know, one source of data. We also relied heavily on online calls, which we organized with participants. You have to be aware that the teams which are working on specific changes are based in 10 to 20 different locations. So it wouldn't have been any difference to do those calls based from California, or to do them here from Hamburg. You would talk to people from London, from Sydney, from Africa, and that's also the way that normative policy changes happens there. So we were in a way participating the same way that a lot of Facebook employees were participating in those calls. So just being physically there, that was neither the start nor the end of our data collection.
Let's talk a little bit more about your time at Facebook. You were there as a researcher. You every day you assisted at the meetings. How did you feel? How did you think they treated you as a researcher? Do you think they acted any different while knowing that you were there?
Well, of course, I was presented as a researcher, and they knew that I was there to observe them. But from what I can tell, either they're all extremely gifted actors, or they're just, you know, they just discussed what they wanted to discuss anyway. It's also not like they have something to hide. You know, there's no big conspiracy at work. They are a team of people who are trying to develop policies that that sometimes implicate difficult choices, difficult weighing of what values are more important. They have a broadly speaking a tendency to err on the side of voice, as they call it. So they do prefer freedom of expression, which sometimes leads to situations where one could criticize that other considerations, such as, you know, user privacy or perhaps human rights related to development, to self-actualization, are slightly underrepresented in the discourse. But you know, these are things we address in our paper. I did not have the feeling at all that anybody was playing to the audience. You know, I was there just, I was, you know, one of many participants in those meetings. I kept a very low profile.
How many people were there in this rule-making team? Well, what is it called officially, policy?
Well, there's the product policy team.
That's the official name of the team that,
right,
that
yeah,
makes the rules.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, that's one of the teams looking at developing the rules that are related to normal user communication. There are also teams related to developing rules on ads. We didn't focus on ads. Depending on the kind of meeting, you would have either one-to-one meetings where they would engage with a specific NGO representatives, for instance, or academics. But most of the meetings were, I would say, between 5 and 10 people, where you would get reports from different parts of the organization, where they would ask, for instance, well, how is Africa feeling about this? Meaning, how do stakeholders in Africa view that possible change? Are there any specific issues we would have to be aware of? You know, are there any culturally sensitive issues that the team lead in Palo Alto might not be immediately aware of? That's why they have local representatives that try to channel local civil society. So they're trying really to. Well, it might sound corny, but we came away feeling that they're really trying to develop sensible standards.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of people are in these teams? Are these legal scholars or people from all over?
They're generally successful, intelligent, younger academics, between people with an academic background, between, I would say, 25 to 35, 40, some exceptions, but that's sort of the normal participant there. They're usually very well educated at very good universities. They've often had already impressive track records of things they did before coming to the team. Of course, this already guides in a way the frames in which they're thinking, but this does not make, you know, Facebook different from any other successful social media company, or you know, any company. If you look at, you know, the people who are driving those companies forward, you would, you know, you would have very similar makeups.
And it's I think it's not dominated by lawyers, or is it?
Oh, no, sorry, no.
Because you asked, I think, for example, our main contact partner, I think he's a historian, or by education. Well, it's a lot of experience in other countries and other fields.
Yeah. So I work with diplomats in a earlier stage of my career, and there was rather a strong feeling of familiarity, because diplomats too don't have a specific specialization, but are often used in different settings from one year to the next. And you would have that there too. So you would have teams of philosophers, of social scientists, of communication scientists, and relatively few lawyers, I would submit, working on different areas, which sometimes change, and over years develop. So there's no high level of specialization, but rather this, this sense of community, the sense of working together on trying to find a good solution, for lack of a better word.
Maybe we can discuss one example of how a certain rule comes about. Maybe we can take the example of the gender identity issue that you mentioned earlier. How does this issue arise within Facebook? Is this something that people from outside take to Facebook and say, "Hey, I feel weird about this. Can you please do something about it?" Or is it people within the team that say, "Oh, guys, we need to maybe set our rules accordingly." And how is it then processed? Like, what is the process of rulemaking?
That rule is still in the making, so I'd probably rather focus on a different one.
Okay.
The one regarding pro white hate speech. If you recall, after the attacks of Christchurch, rather quickly Facebook introduced the rule that certain kinds of white nationalist hate speech would be taken down. And globally, there was this feeling that, well, obviously this was a clear reaction to this single event. But in fact, when I talked to people about that, it turned out that they had been working on a new stricter policy regarding white nationalism for quite some time. What would happen usually is, you would get those signals. People would say, "Well, look at this issue. We can't, of course, in today's political realities, say that that white nationalism is not a problem online. Obviously, it is across the world."
But is it people from outside, like NGOs or other actors?
Yes, NGOs would be one of the sources of those signals. The community would be another one. Employees of the product policy team would look at the kinds of content that are flagged routinely, so the kind of content that other users see as troubling, and they would send reports through the chain, and they would end up with the product policy team. And if the product policy team felt that that there was enough dynamic, enough pressure to start changing a certain policy, they would start this process of developing, of first identifying the issues at hand. Then they would engage with an internal science team who would look at reports and talk to scientists. Then they would start planning which stakeholders to engage with, which calls to make. Afterwards, they would process all of that in a number of working group sessions, and once they felt that they had reached a good proposal, they would bring that to the product policy forum, which is a bit of a mini parliament, if you will, and they would present that there. They have a nice PowerPoint presentation for each policy change, and I should add that those PowerPoint presentations are online by now, so they have opened up the product policy forum. There are many parliament. You can, after a bit of a time lag, you can find all of that online, all those PowerPoints, so anybody can review.
Where can we find them?
On if you just look at Facebook's website and use the search term product policy forum, you will get there. You can also search for
content
standard forum, yes, which used to be the old name for it. And And then they would take a decision on that. So the room would be, you know, there wouldn't be a formal vote necessarily, but the room's temperature would be gauged. In computer science, there's this issue, there's this concept of rough consensus. If, you know, nobody's strongly opposed to it, then, you know, this would be adopted, accepted, and implemented.
And how often do these...
Every second week.
These parliament style.
Mm-hmm. Tuesday evening, every other week.
And how many rules are decided upon during these?
3 to 5, generally. But it's also possible that a rule is sort of sent back to the committees to review.
And is Mark Zuckerberg also part of this team sometimes, of this parliament? What are these meetings called?
The Product Policy Forum.
Forum, okay. Mm-hmm.
I don't think he would usually attend. I got the impression that Ms. Sandberg sometimes attends, but only the way I understood it, about once in a half a year. But that doesn't mean that the leadership is not involved in the process. You know, sometimes those signals to change rules come from leadership. We got the impression that a lot of internally a lot of communication processes are taking place sort of behind the scenes with some reports that send up to leadership to get a first reaction on how they feel about a normative change. So they are involved, depending on the kind of change that's happening.
Okay, let's slowly come to an end of this episode. I would ask you to maybe summarize in a few sentences what is the main takeaway of this pilot study.
So I think a lot of takeaways. We have to be modest because it's just a case study. There are some things that we cannot see. For example, people and we would be interested in, are there intervention into this process for economic purposes? We have not seen that in our observation, but that obviously does not mean that it does not exist. And but coming to the things that we positively have learned is what we can see here is a really separate rulemaking process in which references to other normative frameworks like state law or international law is not very prominent. But nevertheless, it's a process to some extent similar to lawmaking procedures, because what they try to do is to identify the interests at stake and to find a balance there. That is what we can see when we look at traditional state lawmaking. That was the second thing that was striking for us is the importance of the external stakeholder representatives, partly academics, partly representative of interest groups, that in the internal conversation really play a major role. As Matthias pointed out, that it is an argument to know what Africa says or what this interest group says, or whether some academics are okay with that, that have experience in human rights, or freedom of speech discourse, or things like that. So that was two things we found extremely interesting and which will be the basis of our future studies.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Not only in this research project, but in my research program more generally, and in Wolfgang's research over the years, we found out that as communicative spaces where communication that is important for deciding upon the future of the republic and the public, where that happens, that those spaces are progressively privatized, and this means that the character of the rules that impact those spaces are, first of all, private as well. But we can't just stop there as researchers, also as citizens of the world. We have to ask ourselves, we have to inquire really, in how far we can measure those private rules against higher human rights-based standards. And we see, we've seen in this project that that Facebook is doing that. They're trying to slowly trying to put their private norms into context with international commitments. Another, you know, direction they're taking is this new oversight board, which where they're trying to internationalize oversight over content decisions, you know, with the oversight board being responsible for certain specific hard cases, you know. So this is, will be an interesting development we'll focus on too. And perhaps the last thing I wanted to mention, you know, in a lot of criticism of Facebook, there's this feeling that the real product of Facebook is sort of our attention, because they're, you know, they're selling our attention to their advertisers. You know, there's this slightly cynical view saying, well, you know, we are Facebook's product. If you want to take that view, you can. But we came away with a more sophisticated, I would suggest, reading of that. Recall that the part of the company that is dedicated to developing rules is called the product policy team. So we felt that it is better to say that Facebook's product is the socio-communicative space and the rules that form that space. And these two are intricately interlinked. And I think that just that is already an important insight. That under conditions of, you know, today's communicative modernity, the interlinkage between private spaces and the rules are something we have to focus on, and it's not enough to, you know, to rely on those general calls for private companies to be you know, to be respectful of their role and to ensure accountability. We're much beyond that, you know. Just calling for accountability is no longer enough. We need to be firm about the rules these companies develop, and we have to be able to qualify them in terms of their impact on public communication. And our project was a first step towards ensuring at least the database for that.
Looking into the future, will there be more research by our institute on this subject? And if so, what will be its focus?
So that definitely will be. The aspect of private ordering in public communication is something that we want to do research on in the next couple of years. So one thing is taking again Facebook as an example, that these introduction of the oversight board that we will see in 2020 will change the process that we have observed. And we are interested in evaluating to what extent it actually changes. And I think even the people within Facebook that designed this this concept and implemented it cannot really foresee what that actually means, because one view is the oversight board is about individual cases, and so it does not really influence the policy making, the rule making. But when you have leading cases on a specific issue, then and these is not only solving one conflict, but is applicable to many conflicts of that sort on the platform, then that creates a rule. So you cannot really separate the rulemaking from the oversight board work. And what that actually means for these procedures is, I think, open. And it very much depends on the framework for the oversight board and the commitment of the people on the oversight board, whether they just serve Facebook in better applying their own standards, their own private rules, or whether they see themselves as guardians of human rights, as bringing society's perspective into that. And when they do that, then we will at the end have a kind of hybrid normative system that is partly private and partly more constructed from a public societal view. And that is extremely interesting to study, and provokes some very fundamental questions about how we see the normative order of these digitized public spaces.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, just to take one final example, in 2016, a conflict arose when Facebook deleted this iconic a picture of Nick Ut of Fanti Kim Fuk, the girl fleeing from the napalm bombing. You know, remember? And the picture showed, of course, a naked child, something that any algorithm would flag immediately, rightfully so, and delete it. However, this was seen as an act of censorship by Facebook. Now, of course, you have to, you know, think about the concept of censorship. Usually it's something that states do, but here this was assimilated to Facebook. What Facebook did then was to just, you know, restore the image. We believe that the process that Wolfgang so aptly described will lead to a point where these decisions are not taken within a vacuum based on the fiat, you know, of higher-ups within the company, but based on an increasingly dense dense normative background. Simply put, more rules. As society becomes more and more intricate, we give ourselves more rules. As Facebook develops, it gives itself more rules, and it tracks them back to increase the legitimacy to the global stakeholder community. That's something we've seen too. Wolfgang described how the oversight board might impact that process. And generally, and I'm not saying that only as a lawyer, but also as a citizen, having more rules that hold powerful actors to account is always a good thing.
Thank you, Matthias. Thank you, Wolfgang, for these insights into your study. Anyone listening to this podcast requiring more information, you will find the link to the study in the show notes, as well as the link to our website and our Twitter account if you wish to follow us. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bredocast. Wir erforschen was mit Medien.